Yesterday, the sound system started speaking back with no one standing near it. It was the oddest thing, so I don't want to anthropomorphize it too much, but I'm doing a lot of metta for this microphone and stand. Okay, so while we're in the realm of looking at motivation, I want to say a little bit about self-compassion, because it's such an interesting evolution in the teaching of motivation and looking at really what helps us change. So as I'm sure many of you know, Kristin Neff in particular, a psychologist in Texas actually, has taken her own background in loving-kindness meditation and evolved this theory of self-compassion. First of all, contrasting it to what we might ordinarily call self-esteem. Not that self-esteem is bad, but as she describes it, self-esteem is based on, as we know, some sense of accomplishment, some sense of potentiality, which is really great. While self-compassion is more based on finding another way of relating to times when we have made a mistake, when we've said the wrong thing, when we've behaved unskillfully, when we've lost touch with our aspiration, when we've strayed from our chosen course. Instead of belittling ourselves and denouncing ourselves and being totally down on ourselves, just talking about ways we can actually have compassion for ourselves in those moments. And of course, her hypothesis is that that is the most onward leading relationship we can have to those moments. Because our tendency, and we know this just not only from life but from meditation practice, our tendency is to spiral down. So one of the reasons I love the foundational exercise we did of resting our attention on the feeling of the breath is because it's all right there. It can seem so stupid. And as many of you know, I can't remember if I said it yesterday, this was the first meditation instruction I had when I went to India. I'd gone to India to learn meditation, and I really wanted what I considered the most practical, pragmatic, direct approach. I wasn't really interested in those days in studying the philosophy of any system. And I certainly didn't want to adopt a set of beliefs or declare myself to be a Buddhist or reject anything else. I just wanted to know if there were some practical tools I might use that would really help me be happier and more at peace. And so when I finally found what I was looking for, it seemed to me, it was in the context of this intensive 10-day retreat. So I went into that compound, never having meditated before, for one single second before in my life. You know, so there it was. And this was the very first instruction I received. Sit down and feel your breath. And I was just in shock. I thought, feel my breath? I came all the way to India. Now, where's the magical esoteric technique I came for? Feel my breath. That's so stupid. And I thought, how hard can this be? And I was like, whoa, this is not so easy, is it? But as kind of boring or trivial as it might sound, it's all right there. It's extraordinary. It's like if you perhaps have not meditated before, or it's been a long time, and you ran into a friend when you left here, and they said, what'd you do? and you said, I felt a few breaths, my mind wandered, and I brought it back, it would be like, right. You spent a day off? Like, huh? Right, big deal. But it is a big deal. Because that moment of letting go and beginning again, when we're doing it, cultivating a depth of compassion for ourselves is a very big deal. That's different. It doesn't take much introspection to see that our tendency is other than that. It's one breath, it's two breaths, it's three breaths, and we're gone. And maybe we're way gone. Then comes that moment of emergence, which we call the moment of greatest possibility and transformation. And there is such a strong temptation just to spiral out. I can't believe I'm thinking. I'm so stupid. I'm so bad. Yesterday it was a little easier. Why is it getting harder? I'm just getting worse. I shouldn't have gone to sleep so late. I know I always do the wrong thing. Why can't I make good choices? I'm so bad. I'm so stupid. That's common. But the more we look at that, what's the consequence of that? Does it actually help us grow in the practice or anything? It's extending our period of distraction sometimes for a whole huge amount of time, long time. And it's so demoralizing. It's so exhausting. Do we come out of that bout of self-judgment feeling invigorated to try again? Unlikely. One of the great places I learned in my practice, and also in those early retreats, about the power and the beauty of being able to begin again, which is really about self-compassion, was all about one of my teachers was instructing us not to move, not to shift posture in the course of the sitting. And I always moved. I moved every single sitting. And I moved early on in the sitting, not really from pain, interestingly enough, as I discovered when I looked. I wasn't moving because I was in severe pain. I was moving with the first little inkling of discomfort, because as soon as that started, I'd be thinking, what's it going to feel like in 10 minutes? What's it going to feel like in 20 minutes? What's it going to feel like in 40 minutes? And I would feel overwhelmed by all that anticipated problem. I'd feel defeated. I'd give up. Now, just as an aside, you know, the important point is not whether you move or not at all, but it's the learning. That was a very important pattern for me to see, because that wasn't just happening when I was sitting on a floor in India. That was happening. That was my way. Something uncomfortable, difficult, frightening, painful would happen in this moment. And right away, I would think, okay, this is forever. What's it going to feel like in a year? And of course, I felt so overwhelmed so much of the time, not from the actual whatever it was, but from all of that projection and anticipation. So that was really useful for me to see. But anyway, because I was moving in anticipation, not from pain, it meant I was moving just a few minutes into the sitting. And then I might spend 45 minutes judging myself for having moved. Why did you move? You sat longer yesterday. I'm sure you sat longer yesterday. You're always the first one to move. You're always the only one to move. What about that person over there? They don't seem to be moving ever. You know, like, I hate them, you know. I'm always moving. I'm so bad. I'm just like, why don't, you know. So spending all that time, like, sucked into that was exhausting. The irony was that the actual disruption to my concentration from the physical movement was like 30 seconds. And it might be followed by 45 minutes of pretty solid judging. But is that onward leading, really? Is that a way to grow or change compared to realizing, okay, I moved, this is a new sitting right now. Let me be here wholeheartedly. I'm going to begin again, which is what I learned to do. So in the end, I mean, moving or not moving is not really the point. It's just a framework for being able to look at a lot of things in your own mind. So self-compassion is positing that rather than spiraling down into that kind of brutalization of ourselves, there are ways that aren't ignoring the problem. It's not getting kind of happy-go-lucky and all kind of weird about denying problems. It's not that. But instead of taking things so to heart and solidifying our sense of who we are around them, like all bad, instead of judging ourselves so mercilessly, we can have that kind of tenderness, realizing, oh, this is painful. Not bad, but painful. Or that was a slip up. And, you know, Kristen, of course, has her framework of mindfulness and recognizing what's happening and kindness. And interestingly enough, what she calls common humanity, which helps prevent some of what we tend to do, like, I'm the only one who's ever shifted posture in this sacred hall, ever. How old is this building? I mean, India is probably like 1,000 years old. Or I am the only one, whatever it might be, or I am the worst one. And just realizing this is a part of things. And interestingly enough, that recognition doesn't make us lazy, which is the big fear around compassion and loving kindness. That we will need a kind of rage, say, against ourselves to make any sort of change. We will need a sense of outrage, perpetual outrage, to make any kind of change in the world. So these are all interesting things to look at. And, you know, we don't try to believe or disbelieve anything. It's all to be examined. It's quite interesting. So I'll talk a little bit about anger and then we'll have another sitting. In the Buddhist psychology, again, there are considered to be some really positive elements to anger. And I'm also, when I'm speaking about these things, it's not in terms of feeling them or not feeling them. We feel whatever we feel. And it's not bad to feel it. The question is, does it become a motivating force for what we choose to do or say, and therefore become consequential in terms of our relationships and our way in the world and things like that? Okay? So anger is said to have some very positive things to it. Energy. With anger, we're not complacent, we're not passive, we can take a stand, we can say no, we can draw a boundary. Sometimes anger is described as having this kind of cutting through quality. Like we can cut through social niceties and name the thing no one else wants to talk about. You know how sometimes it seems like it's the angriest person in the room who's doing that? Like, let's talk about that, which everyone else is trying desperately to avoid mentioning. So it's got that kind of cutting through quality. It's also talked about the tremendous detriment of acting from a place of anger. Anger is likened to a forest fire, which burns up its own support. That means anger can devastate us. Right? We're the ones who are burning, lost in a state of anger. And like a forest fire, it might take us very far from where we want to be. Anger has a nature of tunnel vision. They call it persecution in the text. So what does that mean? Think about the last time you were really angry at yourself. I don't know how long ago that might have been, but bring it back. Now, in the midst of that state, is that also a time where you think, well, you know, I said that really stupid thing this morning, but I also did that really nice thing for someone else. Unlikely, right? Our whole sense of who we are and all that we will ever be just collapses around that stupid thing we said. I never say the right thing. I'm always wrong. I'm right. So that's the narrowing. It's the tunnel vision. It's the it's like the contraction, the condensation of all sense of possibility. We lose the sense of options. Interestingly enough, anger and fear in the Buddhist psychology, at least in the Theravada school, are exactly the same state. They're just two different manifestations, anger being the outflowing, expressive, energized form, fear being the held in, frozen, imploding form of striking out against what's happening, wanting to declare it to be untrue. So it's got that same effect. If you think about the last time you were really, really afraid of something, our minds in that moment, in the grip, the intensity of that fear taking over, it's not likely a time where we feel we have any options. Well, if it doesn't work out this way, maybe it'll work out that way. I don't think so. Right? It's just not the nature of being lost in that. So there's that terrible narrowing of a sense of possibility. There's also, with anger, when we're lost in it, a kind of delusion because of that narrowing. We miss so much in that. So the story I usually tell goes way back to when I was first using email. It's hard to even remember the time when I started. I was so excited. At first I actually didn't even have my own email address. I was using someone else's, and a friend complained and said, you know, it's a little confusing getting email from this other person that's really from you. So I got an email address, which I still have. It's on AOL, my first one. Somebody recently, I was giving him that email address, and he said, you're on AOL? It was like inconceivable to him that I hadn't changed in all these years. But I told him it was coming back. It's actually very popular now. It's very retro. Anyway, so I'm back in fashion. So I was first using email. It was very exciting, and I was home in Massachusetts in Barrie, sitting at my desk, working on some project, and I went online, and somebody, a friend, sent me an email saying, I don't understand what the problem is with anger. Now remember, I'm not talking about feeling anger, I'm talking about being overcome by anger, and certainly to the point where it's determining our action, where it's really sparking our action. So he said, I don't understand the problem with anger. So I wrote back and I said, well, one of the problems with anger is that when we're lost in anger, we tend to put people in a box. And then I got offline and I went back to my project, and something went terribly wrong in the relationship of my computer and my printer, and I got really angry. So I got down on my hands and knees, and I was like pulling out plugs and putting in other plugs. And the first person I was angry at was, we didn't even have the phrase IT then, was who the person we used to call our computer assistant. I was really angry at our computer assistant because he was on vacation in Hawaii. And I was fuming. How dare you be in Hawaii when I need you? This is such a big project and you're never here when I need you. Totally forgetting in the midst of that fire that the reason he was on vacation was because I had decided he needed a vacation. And I had gone to the airport and used my frequent flyer miles to get him a ticket to Hawaii. But it's like all that information, gone. And the next person I was really angry at was myself. I thought, why can't you be the kind of person who can ever fix these things? You're so inept, you don't know how to do anything. And meantime, I fixed it. But I hardly even paused for a moment to appreciate that fact. I just got back up on my chair and I was working on the project. And at one point I went back online and there was my original correspondent who said, I don't understand what you mean when you say that when we're lost in anger, we put people in a box. So I wrote back to him and I said, well, this is what just happened. I put that other person in a box. I put myself in a box. So it's a very consequential reaction to get lost in. So one of the challenges and opportunities for us becomes, can we have that much energy without the rest, without the burning, without the narrowing, without that incredible tunnel vision, without the loss of options? You know, that real tightening without the delusion and the forgetting. And that's what compassion does. That's why it's such an interesting topic, because it is said to be the quality we can cultivate that will have us be that strong and that clear, much clearer actually. Not passive, not giving in, but coming from a very different place that doesn't have all those attendant consequences and so much suffering for ourselves and for others. So whether it's spoken about or not, compassion is really, and self-compassion is really the primary ingredient in that exercise that we did and we're about to do again, in letting go gracefully, without rancor, without blame, in being able to begin again, over and over again, means that we are relying on and deepening the quality of self-compassion. And that's considered to be the quality that is onward leading, that helps us make progress. Because everything else becomes like a story that we tell. I can't do it, I did it wrong. Let me wait a year, do some remedial work, whatever it is. It's actually that self-compassion that allows us to begin again. And then in that light, just before we sit, what just came to my mind is this very simple image that I've always loved, used by the Buddha. Not the last time I used it. I think two times I used it, ironically enough, the ceiling of the place I was in that moment sprang a leak, so I'm watching. The image is the mind, a mind, your mind, my mind. The mind will get filled with qualities like loving kindness and mindfulness moment by moment, the way a bucket will get filled with water drop by drop. And just that moment, the ceiling started leaking. Anyway, a mind will get filled with qualities like mindfulness and loving kindness moment by moment, the way a bucket will get filled with water drop by drop. I just love that image from the first time I heard it, because right away I could imagine myself standing by that bucket, looking in and thinking, isn't it going to be wonderful being fully enlightened, floating down the streets of New York, wearing my white sari with a beatific smile on my face, and not having the patience and the humility to add one more drop, which is like right now, be here. Or certainly I can imagine myself standing by that bucket and looking inside and thinking, ew, it's really empty in there. That's never going to get filled. And once more, not doing the only thing that actually accomplishes filling it, adding one more drop. And since I started using that example, people have offered supplements to it. Somebody suggested, well, how about standing by your bucket and completely overlooking it in order to peer into someone else's bucket? Like, how are they doing over there? And many, many people come up and say, I think my bucket has a leak. And I say, these buckets don't leak. They don't. So there is a path. There's something we can do. It means when your mind goes all over the place, you start over. Just settle for a moment. That counts. And with enough patience and enough persistence, things really shift. That ratio of moments being gone, being present, it shifts. Things really change, but that's how it changes. Not from a story we tell ourselves about how it could never happen, or it's going to happen for everybody else, or we're so bad, or ineffectual, or, you know, in 10 years it'll be great. I don't know when I'll start, but someday, right? It's like right now. And so that's what we're actually practicing in that exercise. So let's sit together. I don't know if you want to stretch just for a moment. So we're going to do the same exercise in meditation, settling our attention on the feeling, the actual sensations of the normal, natural breath. If you're with the breath at the nostrils, it may be tingling, vibration, warmth, coolness. If at the chest or the abdomen, it may be movement, pressure, stretching, release. Again, we don't want to be naming these things, but feeling them. If you like, you can use that quiet mental notation of in, out, or rising, falling. It's up to you. But the main thing is resting attention on the sensations of one breath. And then the next. And with all those little, relatively minor things that come, the sounds, sensations, emotions, whatever it is, if they're not really pulling you away from the breath, you can just let them flow on by. As you aim your attention toward just one breath. But if you get lost, you get sucked into something, spun around, overwhelmed, or you fall asleep, it's actually okay, because the most important moment truly is that moment when you realize you've been gone. And in this sitting, it would be great to pay careful attention to that moment. How do you speak to yourself? How gracefully can you let go? How much compassion can you have for yourself in coming back? And if you don't, it's no problem. That's good to see. It's actually good to see the nature of that kind of reaction and whether it's helpful or not. So just pay particular attention to that moment when you've been gone, and how you might be coming back. So I'm wondering if you have any questions or comments, anything you'd like to talk about, please feel free. We have a microphone that might work, that will get passed around. And if you could hold it close and try to speak into it, that would be useful, as long as it works. It works at the moment. That's great. Did you all hear that?
No.
So the question was about boredom in practice. You know, we say that boredom is very interesting, and it is, in a couple of different ways. First of all, it's inevitable. There are times when practice just feels excruciatingly boring for a number of different reasons, and it's not a bad thing, really. Sometimes we're in kind of a neutral place, and just in general, we tend to be conditioned to count on strong pleasure or strong pain in order to feel alive. And when things are just kind of in the middle, we do tend to numb out or disconnect and get bored and get sleepy. So that's why it's good to see it. Because one of the things we do over time in the meditation is we get more in touch with subtlety. And so even just these nuances of feelings that are not very bold get more interesting because we're actually perceiving them more. We're able to pay more attention. So that's one thing. Another thing is that sometimes it's good to sit with uncomfortable feelings, because in an ordinary day, in a usual life, we would never sit and actually look at the feeling of boredom or loneliness or so many things. And it's not a bad thing to, first of all, be able to recognize whatever we're feeling and hang out with it a bit rather than recoil from it into action. Sometimes, again, you know, speaking for America, I feel sometimes that it's almost like the whole society is built around the idea that we should never be bored from the moment we're born till the moment we die. And we will do anything to avoid that feeling. So it takes something, you know, to sit and say, okay, what does boredom really feel like? And it's kind of interesting. Sometimes you can just see these layers of anger, resentment, sleepiness, sluggishness. You know, there can be so many things actually composing that feeling of boredom that it's an interesting exploration. To look at any feeling, we need to get some space from the story about it, because that will be, right off the bat, that will be more interesting. Oh, yes. When was the last time I wasn't bored? You know, like, whatever it was. Or I'll always be bored forever. And so, as I described yesterday, what we do with a strong feeling or a feeling we want to explore is we pivot. Rather than what it's about and what we're going to do about it, we look at the feeling itself. What's it feel like in my body? And then you just hang out with it and notice the different layers, whatever appears. Also, we often get bored from half-hearted attention. And so that's something to look at too, and that's quite interesting. You know, if I drink this cup of tea and I'm not really tasting it, and I'm not really experiencing the warmth of the teacup, I'm just kind of vaguely knowing I'm doing it while the whole time I'm completely caught up in something else, is not going to be very fulfilling. Usually what we do is we think, I've got to get a better quality tea. I've got to educate people, not here, of course. I've got to educate people on how to make a proper cup of tea, as British friends will always do in the States. You know, we go somewhere else, like, instead of maybe saying to ourselves, you know, maybe I should pay more careful attention, and it would be a more fulfilling cup of tea. I wouldn't be so bored with it. So the boredom is also it's a good feedback signal for us to check that out. You know, maybe it's sort of like one can easily get into the place of, all right, I felt 50,000 breaths already. You know, who cares what the next one feels like or whatever. And if we see that, then it's like, okay, just this one breath. This is my life, as it actually is, this one breath. And so we really get more wholehearted. And so that really helps too. You know, so that's why it's an interesting state. Okay. So did you hear that?
No.
Okay. So she's talking about being in a cycle of experiencing a lot of anger. And sitting quietly seems to fuel it even more. And some comment about you actually do ujjayi breathing, and that also, which is a kind of yogic breathing, that also makes it more intense. Well, you know, I think there's so many different levels to that. One is we do have cycles of all kinds of things. And I think I quoted him yesterday. One of my teachers, this Indian man named Manindra, where he said, I was very upset about something coming up in my mind, and he said to me, why are you so upset about this thought that has come up in your mind? Did you invite it? Did you say at 12:15, I'd like to be filled with self-hatred, please? No. But when conditions come together for something to arise, it will arise. That doesn't mean we need to feel a helpless victim of it. But if you think about how much energy we expend blaming ourselves, I should have been able to stop it. Why is this still here? I've been meditating for 40 years, more I think. I shouldn't be feeling this anymore. I spent all that money in psychotherapy. Why is it still here? All of this, it's a waste, because you cannot stop something with that kind of absolute determination. This is not going to come up anymore. You can change conditions, certainly, and you can affect a lot of things, but to have that idea that we are going to wrestle control over everything that arises, it ain't going to happen. And it's so unfair to ourselves. It's so unjust, and we do it all the time. So things come up when conditions come together for them to come up. It's like saying, okay, I've grieved enough. I'm never going to be frightened again. I'm never going to fall asleep meditating again. Good luck. You can change the conditions or affect all kinds of things, but you can't really say, I'm never going to fall asleep meditating again. What if you didn't get any sleep the night before? You know, you're very worried about something and your sleep isn't restful, or, you know, so many things might be part of what arises in this moment, so that sleepiness arises. So that's the first thing. And in the light of that, one can be kinder to oneself instead of feeling I shouldn't be feeling it. So then we have some choices. There are different approaches, and you can try them all. Because the idea is not to get rid of what you're feeling, but to be with it in a different way. So that there's more presence, there's more spaciousness, there's more compassion, even as this, whatever it is there. Sometimes we primarily use the tool of mindfulness. It means being with something and seeing into it. So it's not, why are you angry? How are you going to get rid of it? What are you going to do about it? But what is it? As my teacher Manindra also said to me once, that I was all freaked out about experiencing this anger. He said, he was at my center. He was at the Insight Meditation Society in Barrie, which has a big sloping lawn down to the public road, which is called Pleasant Street. And Manindra said, this is how you should be with your anger. Imagine a spaceship has landed on the front lawn. And these Martians come out, and they come up to you and they say, what is anger? What is anger? Not it's right, it's wrong, this is, you know, what I've got to do, but what is this? And so we look, and we see so many things. This is what it feels like in my body. This is like the anger movie. Moments of sadness, moments of frustration, moments of fear, moments of helplessness, as well as moments of rage. It's a compound. It's all these things coming together, coming apart, coming together again, slightly different configuration. It's an alive system, moving, changing. That's sort of the mindfulness approach. And then there might be approaches that are really about antidotes, or one way of saying it is, I mean, I don't know that Ujjayi breathing is the right breathing, for one thing. I think there are other kinds of breathing that are more about calming and self-soothing and things like that, you know. So we look for balance. There's nothing wrong with, especially if you can do it in like a good spirit, you know, almost like a good humor, and saying, I am way out of whack in this direction. Let me try these things to bring some more balance into my system. You know, a classic example would be sleepiness. We try maybe first just to be mindful of the sleepiness and to be aware. But if it's really not making a dent in your ability to be with it, and you're just really, really sleepy, there's this whole long list of things the Buddha recommended to do to try to bring more balance into your system so you have more energy. Open your eyes. Look at aim, you know, instead of like 50 breaths, one breath, like one breath, just now, will pick up one's energy. He said, sit up straighter, pull on your earlobes. I don't know why. I guess the acupuncturist in the room could tell us. Pull on your earlobes. I should get that one. Get up and do walking. You know, there's a whole long list of things to do. And the last thing on the list is take a nap. And I've always liked that. You know, I've noticed that it's on the list and it's not the first thing on the list. So that doesn't mean you berate yourself and you're really angry at yourself as you go down the list. That didn't work, that didn't work. That's what I mean by a good spirit. It's like, okay, I need to be in better balance. So let me try this or let me try that. And so it's like that, and it's the same with that. You know, so what would that be? It might be walking, moving the energy. I mean, anger is a very high energy state, you know, so you want the energy to move and to flow. It might mean another kind of conscious breathing, you know, that is a sort of self-soothing thing. With any kind of high energy state, it usually means space. We need some sense of spaciousness. Because when a big energy is trying to move through a very tight, confined space, it's going to be really jangled. Whereas if a big energy has a big space within which to move, it'll move. That's why things like get outside or, you know, depending on your practice, maybe it's just listen to sound. Forget the breath. You know, just listen to sound, which will help create that sense of spaciousness. If you're doing a loving kindness practice, maybe it's loving kindness for all beings everywhere. Something like that. You know, and everybody picks up their own personal sense of okay, what helps me have a bigger sense of space? And so it's things like that that are really fine to do. It's just like pulling your earlobes if you're really sleepy. You've tried 15 other things. And okay, let's try that. Okay. So the comment was about, I'll use your last example. So, you know, so if, say she's been thinking something very mean about somebody, and she notices that, it feels a little bit complacent to just say, oh, I'll move on now. I'll let go of it and move on. It doesn't feel like it's enough. Well, that's very interesting too, you know. I think that's why paying attention to all our different reactions is very useful. And that, of course, is the fear when people hear something like self-compassion. You know, it's going to be like, oh, yeah, it doesn't matter. You know, I'll just blow that off. I'll just let that go. And sometimes I suppose it could be. You know, it could move over into another territory. It's not meant to be that. But it could, you know, just be like an excuse or something. But it's really not meant to be. And so that demands a lot of very honest looking on our parts. I just think it also is important that we look at the other tendencies. You know, just as I described, say, I moved in the course of the hour-long meditation. I moved early on in the meditation, and I spent so much time judging myself for having moved, and it was not that helpful. When I actually took a look at it, it was exhausting, it was debilitating, it was painful. It left me feeling worse than when I started. And so, is that really helpful? You know, and the grid is not good and bad or right and wrong. The grid is suffering and the end of suffering. Because as we move ourselves toward the end of suffering, that also gives us the energy to care about others, to help others, try to help others, to pay attention to others. Whereas if we're just kind of caught in that spiral, which is tremendous suffering, there's not a lot of juice there, you know, to try to help anybody else. And so coming to a better place ourselves is not a selfish concern or a self-centered concern. It's a very important part of a process of trying to make a difference. And so it just takes some looking, really. It also, you know, your question also reminds me of this distinction that's sometimes made in the Buddhist psychology between remorse and guilt. Remorse being a very, you know, clear, painful recollection of something we've done or something we've said that in a way like breaks the harmony of life. And it's painful to remember that. There's a very beautiful statement from the Buddha when he said, if you truly loved yourself, you'd never harm another. If you truly loved yourself, you'd never harm another. And when we recall the things we've done or said that were harmful, it's like some of that comes back. It's such a painful place that we were coming from and what we did, and recollecting it is very painful. But the teaching is to feel that pain, learn from it, let go of it, and actually that will give us the energy to move on in a better way. And that is in contrast to guilt, which is not that skillful. It's a form of restlessness and agitation where we're just stuck. We just go over and over and over and over and over something, not with an eye to making amends, but we're just going over it and over it and over it. And it's really a form of lacerating self-hatred. And it's not considered skillful because it's not onward leading. It's not the kind of state that actually has us have the energy to say, well, you know what? I learned a very painful lesson. I'm going to try to go on in a different way. We're just stuck. And so it's kind of overwhelming. You know, we might think of it as a fine distinction, but it's a real distinction. And so it's that kind of thing, where we actually pay attention to what are the consequences of nurturing and cultivating certain attitudes, certain ways of being. What are the consequences of nurturing and cultivating others? You know, and then we know. Yeah, well, forgiveness is in there in the sense that what is that letting go and being able to move on? It involves a kind of forgiveness of ourselves. That, of course, is a very loaded word. It can mean so many different things to so many different people. You know, it can mean just that, which I think is what we really mean to say. Certainly within the Buddhist tradition, if we're talking about forgiveness, I think it means just that. And for, you know, in kind of common conversation, use of language, it can assume a whole other aura for people of complacency, saying what happened didn't matter, overlooking things. You know, there's all kinds of things that kind of get woven in that are unfortunate because it takes it, I think, in a whole other direction. In Burmese monastic society, they have an interesting way of saying goodbye, like maybe the close of a retreat or something like that, which I discovered in 1984 when we brought my Burmese meditation teacher, Sayadaw Upandita, to IMS, to the Insight Meditation Society, to lead this 3-month retreat, which I talked about a bunch yesterday. So Sayadaw Upandita had never been to America before, and his particular interpretation of the rules, the monastic rules, is very strict. And at IMS, most of the people who were most familiar with those monastic rules and appropriate ways to behave, like me or Joseph or people, were sitting in the retreat. So we left the poor staff, you know, trying to deal with this big cultural gap. And even though I was on this silent intensive retreat for 3 months, I could tell, you know, isn't that odd? Upandita's now sleeping in the third place that he's, you know, in a month, he's just moved from place. Oh, that's very strange. And, you know, I could just tell, but, and I felt uneasy because it's my place, you know, but I was on retreat. There was really nothing I could do, so, and no one asked me to do anything, so. At the end of the retreat, in saying goodbye, Upandita got up on the stage and he said, so by then, this was like the last day, so I had found out, you know, the stresses and the difficulties and the miscommunications and all that stuff. So he got up on the stage and the way he said goodbye was, if I have hurt or harmed you, knowingly or unknowingly, I ask your forgiveness. And if you have hurt or harmed me, knowingly or unknowingly, I forgive you. And it was almost ceremonial. And I thought, wow, isn't that incredible? Because I could feel a shift inside of me. I realized that were I to see him again, of course, I went to Burma the following year, and he was my metta teacher, so extremely important for me. But I thought, at that time, I thought, wow, were I to go and see him again somewhere, I wouldn't have to worry that he was going to look at me and think, well, you're the one who started that center. You know, where they don't even know how to treat monks. And I also thought, oh, I'm not going to look at him and think, well, you know, you kind of came to the West pretty unprepared for what you were going to find. I thought, we can start over with a really clean slate. And, you know, so that's one whole meaning of forgiveness, is not deciding everything is going to be different, but knowing it's possible we can come to some kind of closure about whatever and begin again there. So beginning again and forgiveness are very connected to one another. Okay, we're going to have to stop now, and we're gonna have some announcements first, and then we're gonna break for lunch and.